Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording of the reading and sermon from our September 27th service. Reverend Bruce Bode's sermon is entitled, Just What is a UU? We've also included the story from A Time for All Ages. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, children. And I do want to talk to you a little bit this morning about the visit this week of Pope Francis to the United States, and perhaps some of you have heard that he has been visiting us. He's come to the cities way on the East Coast, the cities of Washington, D.C., and New York, and Philadelphia. And maybe you heard that people from all over the country are coming to see him. They're lining the streets. They're waiting for hours. They'll wait for hours just to catch a glimpse of this man. Somehow they want to be in his presence, to feel something of the connection with him. So, who is this Pope Francis? Well, he is the leader of a large part of the Christian church, the part that's called the Catholic Church, and as probably some of you know, one of the largest churches in our Port Townsend area is a Catholic church. It's St. Mary's Star of the Sea. And the priest there, a Jesuit, is Father John Topel. He's a friend of mine. Now, but Pope Francis is the leader of not just that church, but all the Catholic churches all over the world, worldwide. He is the leader of the Catholic Church. He comes from the country of Argentina. That's where he was born. That's where he's lived. He's done his work. And now he lives in Rome. He speaks Spanish, and he's been speaking here a lot in Spanish. English is not his first language. First time he's ever visited here. Imagine that. The center of the world, and he's never been here before. Well, now, as the leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis is a person who represents the teacher Jesus of Nazareth from about 2,000 years ago. And it was upon his teaching and upon his person that the Christian church was founded. And one of the main images that we have of Jesus is of a person who opened his arms to everyone, and particularly the poor, those who had nothing, those who were hurting in some way or another. Not only that, he opened up his arms to all the children. He said, let the children come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of God. Pope Francis is reminding a lot of people of this image of Jesus, because that's what Pope Francis does. He reaches out to everyone. He spoke to our Congress the other day, and afterwards there was a meal, you know, where you would think a person who speaks to the Congress would go with all the important persons, the politicians and the businessmen. He would have that meal. Did he go there? No, he didn't. He went to the homeless shelter, 300 homeless. He helped to feed, and then he ate with them as well. So that's what Pope Francis does. And these actions and the attitude of Pope Francis remind me of a story that was told about Jesus. And that's the story I want to tell you. And it goes like this. Once when Jesus was alive, a woman was brought to him by the religious leaders of that time. This was a woman who had done something wrong. And these religious leaders said, this was very wrong what this woman does. She deserves to die. She deserves to be stoned to death. What do you think, Jesus? At first, Jesus didn't answer, but he stooped down and he wrote something in the dust of the ground. Now, nobody knows exactly what he wrote. People would love to know what he wrote, but we don't. And then, as the religious leaders continued to question him, finally he said, let the person among you who is without error, who has never done something wrong, let that person be the first one to throw the stone. And then he leaned down and he started writing on the ground again. Again, we don't know what he wrote, but we would like to. We don't. After a time, people, those who were questioning, started to leave. First, the older ones left, and then the younger ones left. And finally, Jesus raised up again. He was alone with the woman. And he said to her, "Woman, where are those who would condemn you? Are there none who would condemn you?" She answered, "No, sir, they're all gone." Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Now go and live a new life." That's the story that I think of when I think of Pope Francis. My reading this morning is from one of my favorite passages from the last book that the Reverend Dr. Forrest Church wrote. He was a colleague, the most prominent Unitarian Universalist theologian at the time of his death. No one's actually replaced him, so far as I can see. He died of esophageal cancer it'd be a few days 6 years ago, September 24, 2009. The passage I want to read is from this last book that he wrote, The Cathedral of the World, a Universalist Theology. And it, to me, presents a stunning illustration of both the need for and the difficulty of embracing a universalist perspective on religion. This is from the introduction of this book. He says that universalism speaks with particular eloquence to the challenge of our times. Today, our neighbors live not only across the street, but across the world as well. During an age when we share a global economy and communication systems in addition to nuclear and environmental threats, universalism addresses our era's most dangerous dysfunction, theological parochialism. Every denomination, including my own Unitarian Universalist Association, can fall prey to such nearsightedness. To fulfill its promise, modern universalism must witness against fundamentalists on the left as well as those on the right. By definition, universalism is not the property of any discrete religious body, including those that include it in their names. He's speaking about us. To illustrate this point, which pivots at the center of my theology, let me take you on a brief journey. We shall walk together to the water's edge and follow the light of the moon wherever it may lead. We are standing on the shoreline of a mountain lake, moonlight lapping against our boot tips, mesmerized by the golden carpet laid out over the water as if lowered from the heavens to meet us at the very place that we stand. Before us, along the moon's glorious trail, we can see all the way to the lake's rocky bottom. Above the sunken branches, we watch the water dance and sparkle, a rack of moonbeams on each ripple's crest. Across the lake, where the moon is rising, our path turns to liquid gold. Standing on the shore, some distance to our right, a man contemplates the same view, yet appears shrouded in darkness. To our left stands a woman, her silhouette all but obscured by the blackness that envelops her. Pondering these two apparently benighted people, we wonder to ourselves, what can they possibly be thinking? Encompassed by darkness, the lake before them flat and lifeless, if only they could join us at the foot of the moon's luminous path, then they too could bathe in the celestial light. Henry David Thoreau once chastised the Florentine artist and adventurer Benvenuto Cellini for mistaking the aura he saw surrounding his shadow on a dew-drenched day as a special sign of divine recognition. In the moonlight, we experience a like illusion, as do the man and woman to our right and left, who share our vision, though we perceive them to be in darkness. Judging only by what they see, they too may feel themselves uniquely illumined. To their eyes, it is we who appear to languish in darkness. Expressive of both the wonder and the danger of religion, on the one hand, the moon's golden light extends a path across the lake to the feet of everyone who stands under the spell of its supernal glow. On the other, given that each onlooker sees only his or her own golden pathway, all others standing in the apparent darkness, we are left with the impression that we walk the one true path alone, whereas those who fail to join us are lost. Here, nature can serve as our theological tutor. She reminds us that in almost every way that matters, we and our most distant nature, sprung from a single source and sharing the same destiny, are one. This revelation encapsulates the essence of universalist theology. To perceive things as they are, not merely as they appear, we must view things with parallax vision. We must imagine seeing things through others' eyes as well as through our own. This past August, I invited you to suggest some sermon topics, subjects, and themes for this coming 2015-2016 church year. And one of the person's suggestions, which was based on recent family inquiries, had to do with how to respond to the question of just what exactly is a Unitarian Universalist. So this Sunday, as we are still near the beginning of the church year, I thought I'd take this subject on. And what I will do is to approach this question from three different angles, giving three different responses, which is typical of Unitarian Universalists, all right? So let's suppose someone asks you, what is a Unitarian Universalist? One thing you could do is to refer them to the bylaws of our Unitarian Universalist Association, because in those bylaws there are many statements about our identity, purposes, and communal agreements. I suspect, however, that few, if any, of you have ever actually read the bylaws of our association. Actually, many of you, if not most of you, will be acquainted with at least a portion of those bylaws, because you will find them, a portion of them, at the beginning of the hymnal. And I'd like to ask you to take out the hymnal in front of you, the gray hymnal, at this time. And what I want you to do is to turn to the pages that are just before the first hymn, before hymn number one. Those are unmarked pages. It starts, what you're looking for, it says, we, in capital letters, we, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote. So everyone have that place? Now, what you are looking at there on those pages are statements from Article 2, Section C of our Unitarian Universalist bylaws. And these are the bylaws that are popularly known. The top part is known as the seven principles, and below that, the living tradition we share draws from many sources. Those are the six sources. And so one way to respond to the question of just what is a UU, a Unitarian Universalist, would be to refer the questioner to these seven principles and values that we emphasize and to our six sources of religious authority and inspiration. But what I also like to do in our newcomer orientation classes is not only to refer the attendees in that class to these seven principles and six sources, but I also like to refer them to a proposed revision of these sources and principles that came up in 2009 at the General Assembly in Salt Lake City. Now, there was a proposal made to adjust our bylaws with regard to these principles and sources. It was narrowly defeated, but I wish that we had been able to retain at least parts of what was proposed, or to use it as another way, another statement to get at our identity and purposes. So keep your hymnals out, but now in addition, take the bulletin, the order of service, the salmon-colored sheet, and at the end of that order of service, you will see in very small print, trying to save paper, this boxed-in area, this boxed-in part. And what that is the proposed revision in 2009 of the six sources, the second part of that page there in your hymnal. I think the reason why this proposed revision was defeated was because people didn't want to give up those nice phrases that you found in the six sources, which could be easily bullet pointed, more memorable, clearer, easier to teach. Altogether, they were more aesthetically pleasing. But this proposed revision, which you find in the salmon-colored sheet, I think is a wonderfully succinct and currently more accurate statement of who we are. And so put on your reading glasses, if you need to, and follow me as I read this proposed revision of the six sources. So it begins with a couple of statements on the religious heritage of Unitarian Universalism as follows. So it's Article 2, Section C, 2-2 sources. Unitarian Universalism is rooted in two religious heritages. Both are grounded on thousands of years of Jewish and Christian teachings, traditions, and experiences. The Unitarian heritage has affirmed that we need not think alike to love alike, and that God is one. The Universalist heritage has preached not hell, but hope and courage and the kindness and love of God. Contemporary Unitarian Universalists have reaped the benefits of a legacy of prophetic words and deeds. So that's a very succinct statement of the history of Unitarians and Universalism, Unitarians and Universalists. That's the past. And now comes what is current. Namely, Unitarian Universalism is not contained in any single book or creed. Its religious authority lies in the individual, nurtured and tested in the congregation and the wider world. As an evolving religion, it draws from the teachings, practices, and wisdom of the world's religions. Humanism, earth-centered spiritual traditions, and Eastern religions have served as vital sources. Unitarian Universalism has been influenced by mysticism, theism, skepticism, naturalism, and process thought, as well as feminist and liberation theologies. It is informed by direct experiences of mystery and wonder, beauty and joy. It is enriched by the creative power of the arts, the guidance of reason, and the lessons of the sciences. Grateful for the traditions that have strengthened our own, we seek to engage cultural and religious practices in ways that call us into right relationship with all. So this, I think, is about as clear a statement as you can find on who we are as a religious association. And this statement includes, for example, my own favorite source of religious inspiration, modern poetry. It references the creative arts. That's a source that you won't find in the older document. And another thing I like about this proposed revision is that what they were proposing is that these sources precede the principles. In other words, it's as if the principles flow out of these sources. I also think that it's these sources that are the most distinctive part of our association, more distinctive than our seven principles, which many different religious organizations could probably adhere to. But the variety of different sources that we can draw from for authority and religious inspiration is the most distinctive part of our religious liberalism. Now, this proposed revision also put forth a few revisions for the seven principles, shortened a couple of them, and then added one very important word. So if you would again refer to your hymnal, and I'm going to read, these are not the proposed revisions of the principles are not in the bulletin, so I'm just going to read them. You'll be able to follow along and see what minor changes were made or were proposed for those. And prior to the principles in that revision was this statement: grateful for the gift of life, we commit ourselves as member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association to embody together the transforming power of love as we covenant to honor and uphold. And now we have the seven principles. First, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. No change there. Justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. No change there. Acceptance of one another and encouragement of spiritual growth. That's been shortened, and it's also, I think, more inclusive as it's stated that way. Then a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. No change. The right of conscience and the use of democratic processes. Shortened. The goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. No change. And then here's the significant change in the final principle: reverence for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. It's that change of that single word change from respect to reverence. Just a single word, but with huge implications, and I don't have time to go into that right now. So, if the person who asked you the question about what a Unitarian Universalist is, if that person likes words and concepts, then you can refer them to our principles and sources. They are our current ones, are printed up on these little green and white wallet-sized cards, which you can give out to people. You know, and I'm also thinking that I would like to see the proposed revision, even though it wasn't adopted, I'd like to see that also printed up in wallet-sized cards that we can hand out. So if there are staff, office staff here, remind me to talk to you about that. And then here's another little wallet-sized card that you can hand out. What do Unitarian Universalists believe? This was written by my colleague, the Reverend Dr. David Rankin. I served with him as an associate for 16 years in Grand Rapids, Michigan. These are 10 statements about about the commonly held beliefs of Unitarian Universalists. It's beautiful, beautifully worded. This is actually the one that I would start with if you were going to advertise what a Unitarian Universalist is. So, and you can find these, incidentally, on our greeters table, I believe. So that's a fairly lengthy and wordy first response to just what is a Unitarian Universalist. Unitarian Universalists tend to be pretty good at long, wordy responses. There can be a problem, however, with this approach of trying to say what we believe through principles and sources. And that brings me to a second response to this question of just what is a Unitarian Universalist. The problem is this, that when you try explaining what a Unitarian Universalist is by talking about what we believe in terms of principles and sources, you may end up finding yourself frustrated and the inquiring person flummoxed, aghast, or even pitying you. Now, why is that? It's because what you are offering by way of beliefs, well, they are beliefs, all right, but they're not the kinds of beliefs that your questioner is asking about nor interested in. The beliefs that you're talking about are beliefs about values, principles, and processes for living, and they're not about concrete theological answers to specific theological and doctrinal questions, such as, what do you believe about the nature and reality of God, or the authority of the Bible, or the question of salvation, or the issue of good and evil, or the possibility of continued personal consciousness in an afterlife, those kinds of questions. The questioner wants to know what your religion teaches about these kinds of things. And if you don't have ready-made answers, then it's likely that to that person, your religion will appear unsubstantial, shallow, weak, wishy-washy, a pitiable excuse for religion. And in this situation and in the face of such questions, the liberal religionist often starts to wilt and may mumble some off-putting statements. Well, I'm not exactly sure what we believe on these issues, or I guess with us you can believe whatever you want, or I guess we don't have any such beliefs. Now, a member of our congregation recently brought my attention to a website and a short story on that website, which was told by a humorist who was a member of a Unitarian congregation. In her story, which was told to a general audience, this humorist mentioned that she taught classes in the religious education department of her Unitarian congregation. She said about this, "We're Unitarians, and if you don't know what that is, it's a questioning religion that provides no answers and precious little comfort in times of need." Well, in the context, I admit, it was kind of funny. I've also got to say that these kind of jokes are starting to wear a little thin with me. First of all, in my own experience and in the experience of a lot of others I know, that actually it's in Unitarian Universalist circles that we find our answers to theological questions and, in addition, find emotional comfort. Secondly, I think these kinds of jokes ultimately do both a disservice both to others and to ourselves in terms of what our religion really is. What I'd like to point out here is that this approach of ours, of saying that ours is a religion of questions with no answers, is an approach that accepts the doctrinal, that accepts doctrinal religion as normative, as the real, true way of doing religion. And of course, certainly in our part of the world, doctrinal religion is the majority position. And most people, when they think of organized religion, they think doctrine, they think creeds, and probably we do too. So When we say our religion offers only questions, no answers, what I suggest is that we're accepting, we're acquiescing to this majority position, and we're not acknowledging the kind of answers that our way of religion provides. So one thing that you need to know is that when someone asks you, what is a Unitarian Universalist, they are probably asking it from the position of the majority doctrinal religious orientation, and they are expecting that it will be answered from that perspective. And you may also be accepting that as the norm and feeling the frustration of being caught in that situation. There's an analogy that I've referred to before that I like to use here. It's drawn from baseball, and it says that when you get into such inquiries, when people are asking you, what do you believe as a Unitarian Universalist? What I think usually happens is that you are in the visitor's ballpark, and you're not the home team. As I say, most organized religion is premised on having given doctrines to theological questions. But ours is a liberal, that is to say, non-creedal approach in religion, in which our members are not given set answers to specific theological questions by the institution, but rather what our religious institution provides is the opportunity, the space in community to try to uncover and to try to discover the answers to the deepest questions of life in a personal and in a communal way. And so you could try to explain your position to the questioner something like this. You know, it's estimated that there are currently 10,000 distinct different religions on our planet. 10,000, to say nothing of the denominations as well. Within Christianity alone, there are 33,830 denominations of just that one religion. Now, should I expect that one of these 10,000 religions and their denominations, should I expect that they will be the one that will come up with the answers to the questions of life? I think not. So, I don't ask my religion to supply me with the final definitive answers to these questions. What I do ask from my religious organization is that it takes some account of this welter of religions in the world and the diversity of answers and approaches to the religious questions. And what I do look for in my religion is a place where I and others can work on these deepest concerns of life, the concerns that religion has always addressed, concerns that have to do with grounding and centering and valuing. And that's what we're about, or that's what we are trying to be about, imperfect as we are. We're trying to create a loving community where together we are encouraged to investigate and to explore openly, carefully, lovingly, the deepest issues and questions of life, not just from one tradition, but from many or any tradition. And so, no, our religion as an institution doesn't have given answers to your questions. But as a member of that institution, I have answers that I've been helped to discern in that community. And, dear questioner, I'd be happy to share them with you. So, I invite you to ask me any question whatsoever, and I will try to the best of my ability to answer you as honestly and as clearly and as lovingly and as life-affirmingly as I possibly can. So that might be a way that you might respond to the question of what is a Unitarian Universalist. That is to say, somebody said, was this going to be an elevator speech? I say, very high elevator, right? But what I was trying to do there is make the distinction between doctrinal religion and liberal religion, indicating that the liberal approach to the religious questions, even though it is the minority approach, not the majority approach in organized religion, is still a way of addressing the religious questions. And then one final point in this second response, and this is an important one. So I'm saying that with respect to the way organized religion is usually thought of in our part of the world, we're in the visitor's ballpark. When it comes to thinking about what religion is, we're in the visitor's ballpark. But what I want to say is that with respect to larger society, we're in the home ballpark. And that's because our society is, or ought to be, pluralistic. It's a pluralistic society, and we're a pluralistic religious organization. That is to say, we share the general ethos with larger society, and we have been active contributors to that ethos over the years. Now, there's also a problem of communication on this front, because what happens is that we, as a religious organization, get thrown in with the majority of doctrinal religious organizations, which people are leaving in droves. But so our challenge then is to let others in this society know that there's another way of approaching religion. And from the beginning of my time with you, I have thought that that's the audience that we are addressing, not the other religious organizations, but the larger society, those outside religious organizations. They already share our general pluralistic approach to life. They embrace a modern worldview. And what they may be looking for, even unbeknownst to them sometimes, what they may be looking for is an intentional community in which to address life's largest existential and deepest questions and concerns. And what they're looking for is a loving community in which to do that, a community that I would say is both Unitarian and Universalist in its reach, that is to say, embracing both the unity of all and the diversity of all. This brings me to my third and final response to the question of what is a Unitarian Universalist. When a person asks you this question, whether it comes from the doctrinal right or the secular left, before you answer, I suggest that you pause briefly and consider two things. One, that religion is first of all about how we live and how we love. And then two, that the person questioning you is going to find out more about what a Unitarian Universalist is by your person than by your words. So I'm suggesting that whatever words you might say to your questioner, the most important thing will be your person. It will be your attitude. It will be how you embody your religion. And for this, I'm suggesting then that you lead with your heart and not your head. What does that mean, to lead with your heart? So often when we are asked a question like, what is a Unitarian Universalist, we focus on ourselves in either defensiveness and discomfort or in challenge and aggressiveness. We prepare to engage for battle. What I'm suggesting here is that when that question is asked, you step back, you stand back, you check yourself, you take a quick personal inventory, and you focus not on yourself, but you try to bring your focus to that other person, and you prepare to engage that person in an attitude of humility and loving kindness. I suggest that your job there, when you're asked that question, is not to defend your religion, but it's to try to live your religion. That's the job. That's what I spoke about briefly a couple of weeks ago, and even longer near the beginning of the year last year in that sermon, The Heart of Liberal Religion. What is the heart of liberal religion? I suggested the phrase, love beyond belief. It has a double meaning of conveying that when it comes to religion, belief is or ought to be a secondary phenomenon. And secondly, that true religion has to do with the way of living and being in life. It has to do with the way of having your heart transformed. It has to do with following a practice, a discipline, an approach of loving and caring in such a way that it can only be called unbelievable. Loving beyond all expectation. And isn't this what we are finding this week in the example of the Pope's visit to our country? Now, here's a man at the head of a huge religious institution that has doctrines and beliefs of all sorts that much of the world regards as archaic and outmoded. And it has actions and activities on the part of and in the name of that institution that over the years have harmed many in terrible, terrible ways. And yet, here is this man wringing tears of human recognition from persons of all ways of life and from many different religious organizations. And that, I think, is because he leads with his wide open and immensely loving heart. He judges not. He condemns not. He recognizes the humanity of every single person, regardless of circumstance, regardless of past deeds. He experiences his unity with high and low, strong and weak, rich and poor, but particularly with the humble, the hurting, the frightened, the distressed, the dispossessed, the mentally and physically challenged. By the way he moves, by the way he lives his life, Pope Francis has become the Pope for all of us. He has former Catholics considering whether they might be Catholics again. And he even has some non-Catholics asking, and I've heard this, do I have to believe in order to be a Catholic? Well, that's a demonstration of this phrase, love beyond belief. Love that is more important than doctrine, and love that is unexpected, unbelievable, and unstoppable in its reach. So, if someone this week should ask me, so just what is a Unitarian Universalist? I might well say, you see Pope Francis there? You see how he reaches out in love and care for all? That's right. He's my example of a Unitarian Universalist. And you know, I don't think he would mind.